This is the first lecture in the biochemistry unit. It's called Why Study Biochemistry? The Chemistry of Life. So my first question to you is, what has chemistry to do with biology? And the answer is everything. Because it really is the foundation on which all biology is built. And as we all know, a house that is not built on a firm foundation will soon crumble. If you don't understand or you ignore chemistry, the understanding that you have of biology will be superficial or weak. And this is really important because biology has taken a real turn. Back in the early 50s when the double helix structure of DNA was discovered by Watson and Crick, there's been a move to molecular biology. And some of the greatest discoveries in biology in the last 50 to 60 years have been made in the realm of molecular biology. And molecular biology is really founded upon chemistry. And if you go to a UC, let's say you want to be a bio major and you're going to go to a UC, most UCs will not allow you to take a bio course until you've taken a full year of regular chemistry. So you really can't start taking bio until your sophomore year in college. And that chemistry that they want you to take is identical to the AP Chem course that Mr. Porush teaches here. So you really need to know your chemistry. And if you're going to be a bio major, you're going to end up taking a minimum of 2 years of chemistry in college, whether you like it or not. You're going to take a year of regular chemistry, freshman year, and then a year of organic chemistry, sophomore year. And then if depending on what major, like what emphasis you have, you might even take biochemistry during your junior year. So you end up taking a lot of chemistry in college if you're a bio major. So let me give you a little story to illustrate my point. I entitle this Sigmund Freud's Fall from Grace. Freud, who is the founder of psychoanalysis, is, I would say, the thinker whose work suffered the greatest rise and then the greatest fall from grace in the 20th century. Back in 1900, he rocked the scientific world with the publication of his revolutionary book entitled The Interpretation of Dreams. And by the middle of the 20th century, he was universally esteemed in the West as the man who had uncovered the deepest truths about human motivation and desire. He really got inside of the brains of humans and really started to make sense of what was going on inside this black box of ours. And he actually believed that mental illnesses, and this is in this I'm including serious diseases like manic depression and schizophrenia, were psychological in nature. And so therefore, he invented a therapy, a way to cure these problems, and what has been termed as talk therapy. And this is the classic picture of the psychoanalyst who has the patient lie down on a sort of a little sofa or a little bed in their office, and then they talk about, you know, their childhood issues and, you know, this whole thing about you get the Oedipus complex and you all this crazy stuff. But by the end of the century, Freud was regarded by most of the medical profession as little more than a footnote in intellectual history and someone who is more of a philosopher than a scientist. And the only place you really see that Freud still maintains sort of his esteem is in English departments, who love to use Freud to analyze literature. They love to, you know, talk about the Oedipus complex and, you know, the id and the super ego and the ego and all this kind of stuff. And so English professors love to talk about Freud, but medical professionals, they don't really have much regard for him. Anybody ever heard of this person, John Cade? Anyone ever heard of him? No one. It's a shame, because John Cade changed the world. In 1949, John Cade, who is an Australian psychiatrist, made an amazing discovery that would eventually marginalize Freud and his ideas. And what he did is he miraculously cured some of his manic depressive patients, not by talk therapy, but by simply administering the drug lithium. That's right, lithium. You know the periodic table? You look at that element, lithium. Just by giving him the element lithium, well, in a form of a salt, he cured them. And so by the end of the century, Freud's talk therapy had been replaced by Cade's drug therapy. And as a result, a slew of drugs have been developed over the last 50 years that affect the brain. The success of antidepressants has been absolutely phenomenal, like Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, and there's many, many others. To this date, over 28 million Americans have taken Prozac. That's 10% of the population. And if you ask anyone who has gone through fits of depression and has taken one of these drugs, and it's not always Prozac. Sometimes it's another one of these that works better. So once they figure out which one works best, it's amazing. You ask these people, and it's literally like night and day for them. And if you want to take a look over at this pie chart, take a look at the U.S. market share of antidepressants in the first half of 2005. And this is by sales in billions. And if you look at it, the total here is $5 billion were spent on antidepressants in the first 6 months of 2005. And here are the big sellers. Now, obviously, it's a few years later, and so I'm sure this number has gone up. But it's a remarkable and staggering figure. So let's compare Freudianism versus biochemistry. So I've got an analogy here. So here we go. Freud had a theory of the brain and how it works and in controlling human behavior. And my analogy is, it's similar to a situation in which a group of primitive tribesmen find a working automobile and they try to develop a theory to explain its functioning without ever being able to open the hood. So they might observe a strong correlation between stepping on the gas pedal and moving forward. They might theorize that there was some device connecting the two and converting a liquid into the motion of wheels, or perhaps a large squirrel in a cage, or whatever. I mean, who knows? Because they could never look under the hood. They would have no understanding of hydrocarbons, internal combustion, valves, pistons, all the things that actually do the energy conversion. Well, the triumph of biochemistry. Unlike Freud's theory of the unconscious, which makes these entirely speculative, unprovable claims about how the mind works, biochemistry actually allows us to lift the hood and peer in. And even though it's tentative, we can actually look at the internal workings of the brain. And what we've discovered in the last 50 or 60 years is that there are a dozen or so neurotransmitters such as serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine that control the firing at nerve synapses and the transmission of signals across neurons in the brain. And that the levels of these neurotransmitters and the way they interact affect our subjective feelings of well-being, self-esteem, fear, and so on. It's really amazing. And if you look at this next slide, you'll actually see how the synapse functions. You'll see the transmitting cell, that's the neuron that receives the actual signal comes down that neuron, and as a result, neurotransmitters, which are colored here in red, are released. They go across this gap, which is called the synapse, And then they bind to receptor molecules on the next neuron, and that causes that neuron to send an electrical signal along the way. So it's really these red signal molecules, these neurotransmitters, that have a lot of the power in controlling how signals are transmitted through the nervous system. Now, I'm going to state something, and this you're going to hear this again and again. Structure often determines function. And it turns out that molecules that are similar structurally have the same effect within an organism. For example, morphine, which is a chemical found in the opium poppy, which is widely grown now in Afghanistan, blocks the transmission of pain in neurons. And so if you actually look at my little illustration here, you'll see that the green little spheres represent the neurotransmitter. And then there are receptor molecules which open up and allow ions to move through them, the yellow ions, and that allows a nervous signal to be sent down that neuron. Morphine blocks those channels and prevents these ions from going down and therefore prevents transmission of nervous signals down that neuron. Endorphins, which are chemicals found in the human brain, also block the transmission of pain in neurons, very similarly to what morphine does here. And on the next slide, what you see is that the actual functional part of morphine, which is in the lower left of the morphine molecule, if you look over at the endorphin, which is at left in my picture, it has a shape that is identical to the shape of the morphine molecule. And so because they have identical structures, they have the same function. They will block the transmission of nervous impulses in the neuron on the other side of the synapse. And you've probably heard of endorphins because they're the chemical that causes runner's high. We produce them in our brain, so if you go on a run, after a certain while, you'll start producing endorphins, and these endorphins will do just what morphine does, and that's why people get addicted to running, okay, because they're producing a morphine-like substance in their own brain. So this shows you the power of understanding biochemistry and what it can do to the human brain. And so I hope this convinces you that what we're going to do over the next week and a half, even though maybe you don't love chemistry, it's super important. And it's actually really, really exciting. And we will take this basic foundation of understanding of chemistry and we'll build on it throughout the year. So once again, that's why we begin with this unit on chemistry right after our evolution unit. Okay.